I do this with some fear and trepidation. It took me a while to decide that I would really address this topic among you, because here I come among you who know more about this topic than I do. The center of what I want to talk about is, in fact, Benjamin Keach, The Breach Repaired, which all of you know about. I decided I would do this, however, because in my travels across the country and also in my own tradition, I have discovered that people don't know their own traditions very much at the present moment. And also I have appreciated people who come from outside my tradition speaking to me about my own tradition and reflecting on it from different perspectives that I might have. So I hope I get it right. You can tell me if I get it right or not. My plot is to summarize what I take to be the issues involved in the 17th century, specifically with reference to that particular topic, Keach and the Breach Repaired and what preceded it, and then to make some reflections about it. As usual, when I do things like this, it gets out of hand. So it's a paper of 21 pages now and about 50 footnotes, almost 50 footnotes. So there's not enough space or time here to do the whole thing. So I will abbreviate. The first part I'm going to just skip over. I'll tell you what it is. It's something that doesn't need to be said, but I thought I should do it anyway. It's just a demonstration of how important psalm singing is in the 16th and 17th centuries, and I do it in three ways. The psalters which are produced, I just do a real brief survey of Sternhold and Hopkins, 16th century, and then some lesser known ones in the 17th century. Then some external sources which indicate the importance of psalm singing, like the famous quote from John Jewell, Cromwell's men singing at Dunbar, that sort of thing. And then finally, a series of rubrics that come from Puritan worship services. That's all clear, though I felt I had to detail it. What it obviously means is that there is broad support for psalm singing across the 16th and 17th centuries and across the English-speaking church. But though there was broad support, as you know, the support was not universal. There were those who objected, and that's what I want to deal with here. What has intrigued me my whole life is why some communities sing and why some communities don't sing. And I encountered this particular dispute in graduate school, so this gave me a chance to revisit it. Now let me try to summarize what I take to have been going on here. If Horton Davies is right, the earliest opposition to singing came from Puritans, and eventually it's the separatist Puritans who were most objecting. The Puritans in 1539, as early as 1539, as Davies said, fanned opposition to singing with conjoint voices and contributed to the eventual burning of Coverdale's ghostly psalms and spiritual songs. Then in 1586, a little bit later, the Puritans proposed, quote, that all cathedral churches may be put down where the service of God is grievously abused by piping with organs, singing, ringing, and troweling of psalms from one side of the choir to the other. Separatist groups, as I said, tended to be most suspicious of psalm singing. The Barrowists at first did not use hymns or psalms at all, but Francis Johnson, a Barrowist pastor in Camden and Narden, did introduce psalm singing in his congregation. Frank Johnson, being advised by one that talked with him thereabouts in the Clink at London, you have all these people being put in jail, so they discuss things like psalm singing in jail. Frank Johnson did press the use of our singing psalms, neglected before of his people for Apocrypha, whereupon his congregation publicly in their meetings used them. Henry Barrow, the founder obviously of the Barrowists, did not oppose singing of psalms as such, but he was against metrical psalms and hymns. In a dispute with Gifford, he wrote that he was not, quote, against that most comfortable and heavenly harmony of singing psalms, but against the rhyming and paraphrasing the psalms as in your church, nor yet so much against that as against the apocrypha erroneous ballads and rhymes sung commonly in your church, instead of the psalms and holy songs of the canonical scriptures. Robert Brown, founder of the Independents, related to the founding of Congregationalists, and his followers rejected singing metrical psalms because singing of a group, that is, with conjoint voices, required a set form, and because singing a metrical psalm was an alteration of the words and possibly the thoughts of Scripture. Psalms also reminded Brown of gaming in worship. He considered it vanity, gaming in worship, tossing psalms back and forth from one side to the other. Extemporaneous singing was apparently okay for him. Extemporaneous singing, that it would be obviously of a single person, that was apparently okay, but congregational singing, which required a set form, was not okay. And a similar position was apparently taken by the early Baptists. John Smith of the Gainsboro Separatists and eventually the pastor of the Amsterdam Baptist congregation wrote the following in 1608. I assume you all know all about this, but just to make sure, let me quote. We hold that the worship of the New Testament properly so called is spiritual, proceeding originally from the heart, and that reading out of a book, though a lawful ecclesiastical action, is no part of spiritual worship. We hold that singing a psalm is a part of spiritual worship, therefore it is unlawful to have the book before the eye in time of singing a psalm. In his certain demands, Smith asked the following rhetorical questions. Again, I quote, whether the apostles did not pray, prophesy, and sing psalms as the Holy Ghost gave them utterance? Whether as in prayer and prophecy, one alone speaketh, and the rest pray and prophesy by consent? Whether in a psalm a man must be tied to meter and rhythm and tune, and whether voluntary be not as necessary in tune and words as in matter? Whether meter, rhythm, and tune be not quenching the spirit? In 1609, Ainsworth wrote to Smith, asking him why he allowed singing in worship, why he allowed it, but did not practice it. That's a very interesting question, and what it indicates is that allowing extemporaneous singing by the individual, though these men might have allowed that, in fact, that was more theory than practice. So that in fact, those groups that said you couldn't sing with conjoint voices, though you could have an extemporaneous person singing, or extemporaneous singing by a single individual. In fact, those groups apparently didn't practice singing at all. Obviously, that's a very tough thing to do, and you're not going to extemporize as a group. Unless, of course, you have Michael Hahn to provide you the frame, right? The Quakers also were among those who rejected psalm singing. Robert Barclay said, "But as for the formal customary way of singing, it hath no foundation in Scripture, nor any ground in true Christianity." Now, these objections to psalm singing in the latter half of the 17th century were sufficiently strong to produce a series of treatises for and against the topic. I assume you know all about them, but let me detail them to remind you. 1640, the preface to the Bay Psalm Book, which was present not only on this side of the Atlantic, but traveled back and forth. John Cotton had something to do with that, apparently. So 1647, Singing of Psalms, a Gospel Ordinance, which also traveled back and forth on both sides of the Atlantic, though I think it was first published in London. Thomas Ford, Five Sermons on Singing of Psalms, the Duty of Christians Under the New Testament. Cuthbert Sydenham, A Christian Sober and Plain Exercitation of These Times, Infant Baptism and Singing of Psalms. He's in favor of it, but he's against organs and harps. He's against instruments, in other words. Isaac Marlowe, Prelimiting Forms of Praising God, Vocally Sung by All the Church Together, Proved to Be No Gospel Ordinance, 1691. Isaac Marlowe, An Appendix, 1691. And then Benjamin Keach, The Breach Repaired in God's Worship, or Singing of Psalms, Hymns, and Spiritual Songs, proved to be a holy ordinance of Jesus Christ, with an answer to all objections, as also an examination of Mr. Isaac Marlowe's two papers, one called A Discourse Against Singing, etc., and the other an appendix. So you know you have these long Puritan titles which go on for the whole page. So those seven, basically, it seems to me, cover the waterfront at the end of the century. Let me detail the issues by using John Cotton. It seems to me John Cotton, the Singing of Psalms, a Gospel Ordinance, 1647, summarizes these issues best. And he does it in four categories: the duty, the matter, the singers, and the manner of singing. So let me just summarize first what John Cotton says. Duty, first. Cotton was convinced that singing of psalms with the actual voice is a duty for Christians. And he proposed three proofs. First, Ephesians 5:19, Colossians 3:16, and 1 Corinthians 14:15 and 16 all mean for him the actual use of the voice, not just singing with the heart. Come back to that. Second, there are New Testament examples: Christ and the disciples after the Lord's Supper, and Paul and Silas singing in prison. So you have the examples in the New Testament. Third, there are Old Testament prophecies that foretell the New Testament duty, and he gives you the places where you can find them. The most telling point, perhaps, is this: that if our hearts sing with joy and our glory, our tongue is silent. If our hearts sing with joy and our glory, our tongue is silent, we dishonor our chief singer, Christ, because Christ himself rejoiced with his glory, his tongue, at the Last Supper. So that's the first point, the duty. Second, the matter. Cotton sounds like a true Calvinist. He is a true Calvinist, I think. In private, he says, Christians may use psalms or other scriptural songs or even newly composed ones. You can do all of that in private. You can even use instruments in private if you want. But in public gatherings of the church, a special occasion might call forth a psalm composed by a member of the congregation, that is to say, not from the psalms in the Bible. But normally, and ultimately it seems to me normally means virtually always, normally it is the Psalms of David that are employed. Why? Because both Ephesians 5:19 and Colossians 3:16 tell us to sing psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs, which, says Cotton, are the titles of David's psalms. You may regard that as a spurious exegesis, but nonetheless that's what he says. The question of whether it is acceptable to use set or pre-composed forms then arises, and Cotton says there's a difference between set forms of prayer and set forms of psalms. The former are of human devising, that is to say, set forms of prayer, while the latter, set forms of psalms, are appointed by God. So then, obviously, you use psalms. Finally, Cotton tells us that Colossians 3:16 instructs us to use psalms for instruction, admonition, and for praise and thanksgiving to God. Then he says, since there is no ordinance which appoints somebody to psalmistry, the same as there is for preaching, prayer, and rule, that is to say, elders. You have somebody appointed to be an elder for preaching, prayer, and rule, but there's no appointing of somebody to psalmistry, since that's the case, the whole congregation has to do it. It's a very interesting argument. I want to come back to that when I reflect on it. Third, who is supposed to sing? Three subheads. One, whether one person ought to sing and everybody says an amen, as Smith indicated in some of his comments there. Whether, second problem, whether women may join men in singing. Third problem, whether carnal men or pagans may join Christians. Okay, you see the three problems. First, says Cotton, everybody ought to sing. This gets very convoluted in usual Puritan fashion, with copious biblical citations to prove the point. But essentially, Cotton says, singing is not prophesying in which only one person speaks. It is not confusion when all people sing together. Though there may be no scriptural example, there is scriptural warrant. And singing together does not make everybody a teacher, since only the one who appoints the psalm is the teacher. You follow the logic of that? The person who chooses the psalm is the teacher, but singing together does not make us all teachers. Okay? Second, women are not permitted to teach. They are not permitted to ask questions in church. They are permitted to give an account of their offense in church. Okay? And they may sing. And they may sing with the men. I'll come back to that one too. Third, Cotton argues that the church is called to sing for mutual edification, that praising God with psalms is comely for the upright, whether or not they are members of the church, and that the chief ground for psalm singing is that it is a duty laid on all people, whether they're Christians or not. Psalm singing is a duty laid on the whole human race, presumably. Singing instructs the wicked, and it is the job of the whole creation, not just Christians, but the whole creation to glorify God. So, of course, carnal human beings and Christians all sing together, right? That's the third point. Fourth, the last issue is the manner of singing. This refers in the first instance to whether or not it is lawful to devise meter and tunes. Well, says Cotton, it's apparently lawful to translate the Bible so we can understand it. Therefore, it must be lawful to translate the Psalms. And since God has hidden from us the music which originally accompanied the Psalms, in typical Calvinist language, Cotton says it must be, quote, that God allows us to sing them, to sing the Psalms, in any such grave and solemn and plain tunes as do fitly suit the gravity of the matter, the solemnity of God's worship, and the capacity of a plain people. Very, very Calvinist kind of statement. Further, says Cotton, meters and tunes help stir up the memory and help stir up the affections. Also, very Calvinist kind of statement. The other issue here is lining out. Is it okay to line out or not? Well, says Cotton, where people have the book, it's not a necessity. But where they don't have the book, it's fine, and it's done by one of the elders. Okay? Now, I think that basically lays out all the issues that are involved in this dispute. It's a good summary of them. Let me go on to Benjamin Keach now and just say a word about him, then I want to make some reflections about this. John Smith's position, as I understand it, was representative of 17th century Baptists generally. As William Reynolds points out, Baptists in 17th century England were opposed to psalm singing and worship. In 1689, the General Baptist Assembly concluded that psalm singing was, quote, so strangely foreign to the evangelical worship that it was not conceived any ways safe to admit such carnal formalities. That's 1689. Benjamin Keach, as you know, a particular minister, Baptist minister, at first opposed psalm singing with conjoined voices in the usual Baptist fashion, but then he changed his mind. Between 1671 and 1675, he introduced singing into his church at Horsleydown at the Lord's Supper. Between 1677 and 1679, he introduced the practice in mixed assemblies on days of thanksgiving, at baptisms, and on other occasions. Sometime before 1691, his congregation decided with only 5 or 6 negative votes to sing on Lord's days after the sermon and when prayer ended. This split the congregation, as I assume you also know, and some people left his church. At about the same time, there was a lay member of a church in Mile End Green named Isaac Marlowe who opposed singing in worship, and he put his thoughts in writing. His tract was called Discourse Concerning Singing. Keach responded with The Breach Repaired, and the pamphlet war was on at the end of the 17th century. Keach wrote a half a century after Cotton. He quoted Cotton, he quoted Sydenham, Roberts, Barton, and others. Keach's writing, it seems to me, can be viewed as a kind of freewheeling, rambling summary version of Cotton and those who followed him. He's much more difficult to read than Cotton. Cotton is very clean and precise. Keach just sort of rambles all over the lot and has expansions and additions as he goes, and makes sure also that he's always answering Isaac Marlowe. He did, however, expand Cotton's Calvinist stance. Keach saw no reason to restrict congregational song to psalms, and he wanted to include hymns as well. So what you get in Keach, if I understand this right, is something that Watts is going to say just a little bit later. For Keach, the breach was the lost and neglected ordinance of singing psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. That's a quote. The breach is the lost and neglected ordinance of singing psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs. Restoration of singing, said Keach, would make the congregation complete in the whole will of God. Now, that is very strong language, but it is even stronger if you consider the choice of the word breach. He chooses to use the word breach, and in his vocabulary, that's a very strong word. He also, as you probably know, wrote a whole gob of hymns, which have passed out of the repertoire. I think probably most people would be thankful that they have passed out of the repertoire. But in one of them, he uses the word breach to describe the break between God and humanity caused by sin. Here's one of the hymns that Keach wrote. A breach most sore there was between poor sinners, Lord, and thee. Before the fall, not then was seen, but perfect amity. Breach is a very strong word for Keach. So this is a serious matter. This is a very serious matter here for Keach. He pointed out that just because a group, like, let us say, Roman Catholics or Quakers, holds some errors, that is no reason to suppose that they hold no truth at all. So, he says, singing needs to be restored. It needs to be restored no matter how hard that may be, and no matter who else does or does not do it. We have to restore this. So then he presently launches into a lengthy section which essentially says it's nonsense to talk of singing with the heart and without the voice. That was obviously one of those issues that he had to deal with. And then he's off to all of the other issues that Cotton and the others discuss in the last half of the century here. Now, I hope I've gotten it right, sort of at least, and have sketched out what are the dimensions of this dispute in your own history. You can all instruct me and tell me later if I've messed up somewhere, but I think that's basically an overall summary of what the issues are here. Now, what do we make of this? What do we make of this 17th century squabble? Is this just some illustration, one more illustration, of the church at war over silliness? I mean, is this like how many angels can dance on the head of a pin? Is this just some stupid dispute that these people had back then? Is this sort of antiquarian excursions that folks like me who like to dig this stuff up find out about, but it doesn't have any relevance to us? Or is there more to it than that? Is there something we can learn from it? I think there's more to it than that. I think there's something we can learn from it. And what I'd like to do is do a modest list here of what some of those things might be. And I hope it just stimulates your imagination to figure it out for yourselves. This is not considered to be a complete list. And I may be even wrong. But here are some things it seems to me it might mean for us. First, we live in the midst of numerous conflicts about music. Obviously, numerous conflicts about music. And these conflicts are not simply your problem or my problem. Yours as Baptists or whoever you may be, or mine as a Lutheran. From Baptists to Roman Catholics, it seems to me we are in the midst of deep conflicts about music, and they relate to many of the same issues. We often conduct those conflicts as if we were the first people in the world to ever have them, as if we were the first people to ever think about this stuff. At the very least, dipping into the 17th century teaches us that we are not the first people to think about this stuff. We're not the first people to think about matters that relate to music in connection with the Christian faith. If you look a little more, you discover that the 17th century was not the first century either. And pretty soon it becomes clear that the church has a history of hymnic and musical discussions, the same as it has a history of virtually everything else. Maybe they can teach us something. They surely tell us that we're not the first to discuss these things, and it may be that looking at the minutes of past meetings might give us some clues to where we came from and therefore where we are, and we may not, maybe, perhaps, we may not repeat mistakes of the past, possibly. But at least we have a shot at that if we read the minutes of the past meetings. It also might be some source of comfort. I mean, to assume that we're not the first to ever think about this can be a source of comfort, and I think it perhaps could also induce some much-needed humility. This assumption that we are the first people to think about anything, I mean, sometimes I read some people as if we in the late 20th century are the first people who ever had sex or something like that. It's very, very strange how we have the idea that we are the first to do virtually anything. And especially maybe the first to think about musical matters in the church. In any case, there may be some source of comfort by reading this, and it may induce some humility. Second, in some respects, this conflict seems very quaint because it raises issues that are self-evident to us. Let me detail a couple of those, several of those issues that seem self-evident. Most Christians are not likely to ask this kind of question. Most of us Christians simply take it for granted that we sing in our worship. We just take it for granted. This controversy may remind us that while singing at worship has been a spontaneous kind of reality for most Christians in most times and places, it's very difficult to keep Christians from singing if you study the history of the church. Very, very difficult. I would say probably impossible. So though in most times and places Christians have kind of sung spontaneously, for others, singing has been won through considerable struggle. It might be that gratitude is a proper response. Somebody had to struggle about this and think about it and work at it. So maybe gratitude is a proper response. Second, this is another element of the quaintness of the dispute. Asking if women should sing seems quaint and self-evident too. We're not likely to ask about that question. That may lead us to see that we still have work to do on women's rights. It may be self-evident to us that permitting women to sing is not even a question. But at other points, which will be incredibly self-evident to those who follow us down the road somewhere, at other points, it will be very, very clear that we have kept women as second-class citizens and that we have still not figured out how we live out the reality that in Christ there is neither male nor female. We have lots of work to do at this one, I think. And perhaps reading this kind of material from the 17th century, as we look back at it, may give us some sense of how people are going to look back on us and may encourage us strongly to think about issues of justice with reference to women. Third, the notion that texts like Colossians 3:16 can be understood to mean silent singing may also be regarded as quaint. This may seem very strange to us, but the 17th century writers about this were not the first to ask that question either. Ulrich Zwingli in the 16th century had argued exactly the same logic. He had said Colossians 3:16 means singing in your heart. It doesn't mean actual physical singing. Keats spends a good deal of space and energy about this matter, So he obviously did not take it lightly, and maybe we shouldn't take it lightly either. But I think perhaps what we need to do is to consider it in a different sense. We are not likely to argue the case for silent singing, either the way Zwingli did or the way the opponents of Cotton and Keach did it. We're not likely to argue that. I have never heard anybody in the 20th century, in my life at least, argue for silent singing in a church, except, of course, Quakers. And they wouldn't say silent singing. They would say be silent. And I agree exactly with what Michael Hahn said. We need to take very seriously the Asian concerns or Quaker concerns about silence. We run from silence in our day, which is maybe why music turns out to be so meaningless, because you can't have music against a backdrop of silence because we're so afraid of silence. So we need to take seriously what the Quakers are saying, I think. But they're the only ones, I think, who would argue for silence. Everybody else would argue for some kind of singing, at least in my experience. But we practice silent singing for our congregations, even though we don't argue it. And we practice silent singing every time we set up the leaders of worship as a self-contained unit so that the people and their singing become irrelevant. This happens every time you have organs and choirs or amplified vocalists and bands or synthesizers and other equipment, or any place where you have a sonic environment that substitutes for the congregation singing. We do this in all sorts of ways, but we figure out ways to substitute. We make a complete sonic environment that's a substitute for the congregation singing. In effect, the congregation is then silent. I've heard David Cherwin, a very perceptive and able church organist in Minneapolis, whom many of you probably know, I've heard Cherwin say that when the people do not sing, there should be a perceptible hole in our worship, a hole that can't be filled with other sounds. And I think he's absolutely right. The logic of Cotton and Keach, that singing means actual physical sound, does not mean the congregation cannot listen at some points. Does not mean also that there can't be silence. Cotton and Keach would probably disagree with me, but I would say there are points in a worship service where listening is exactly right. Listening to lessons, listening to the choir. Exactly right. But those points cannot substitute for the congregation's song. The congregation has its own role to play and its own song to sing. Actually, when you think about this, it may well be, and I've grown to reflect upon this even more and more, it may be that we are closer to the Middle Ages than we are to the 17th century. It may be that what we are doing is silencing congregations the same as happened in the Middle Ages, and we are substituting for them with this complete sonic environment, the same as happened in the Middle Ages, so that congregations turn out to be silent or near silent. I've often visited many congregations where I thought, if you took away the sounds that all the leaders of worship were making, well, not, it's very clear if you did that, you would have total silence, or near total silence. It's very close to what the Middle Ages were up to. The reformers in the 16th century and Vatican II in our century all argue against that. All argue against that. If we don't heed their warnings, if we don't do the hard and delightful work of helping people and teaching people to sing the faith, it seems to me we can expect a new Reformation-type clarion call against our faithlessness. And I've worried about that more and more. I think we may be headed for a new kind of Reformation call against our faithfulness, the same as the Reformation did against the medieval faithlessness. That's the second point, the quaintness of this dispute, which may, in fact, elicit several issues we need to think about. Third, Cotton makes this very interesting observation. He points out that elders are appointed to preach, pray, and rule. There is no similar appointment to psalmistry, he says, and therefore it is the congregation's responsibility to do it. Now, those thoughts of cotton lead to all the questions about polity that we all face. How are you organized? Do you have bishops? Do you have elders? Do you have other sorts of overseers? Who is responsible to whom? How lines of authority flow? Whether you call your spiritual leader a minister, a pastor, an elder, a priest, whatever. I don't want to enter that arena. I want to reflect, rather, on what this might mean for the vocation of the church musician. I don't mean to say that other stuff is not important. It's very important stuff. But I want to bracket that out for the moment and reflect on what this might mean for the vocation of the church musician. The point that Cotton makes, that singing belongs essentially to the congregation, is very perceptive. It suggests that the uniqueness of the musician's office, or the uniqueness of the musician's role or vocation, is different. It is clear that we need someone to preside at worship. It is clear that we need someone to preach at worship. That's clear. And those offices require a person who is quite visible in some sense and who stands over against the congregation in some sense. If the person does those things well, attention obviously is called away from that person to God, whom the whole worshiping community is pointing to. But the visibility and the clarity of this person and this office, if you want to use the word office, is very hard to deny. When it comes to musical leadership, things are different. There may be a leader of the song who sings or conducts or plays the organ or some other instrument, and we obviously do need such a leader. You have to have somebody who does something like that. But Cotton is absolutely right that the whole congregation does the singing. That means the musician who leads this singing, the better he or she does the job, the more he or she gets out of the way, so that the people can sing, and the focus is on the people's song. The musician then turns out to be invisible in a way the preacher and the presider is not. Obviously, leadership can be exerted from in front of a congregation by a conductor, so obviously the person is visible in that sense, but it can also be exerted invisibly. You can initiate singing of a congregation from within the congregation, from behind the congregation with an organ, as some traditions have, etc. So the leadership of the individual cantor, the leadership of the individual musician, becomes invisible in the sense that the presider and the preacher does not. That means the presider and the preacher, the one whom Christians call by the name minister or pastor or clergy or preacher or priest, is invariably identified and defined with the clarity, a clarity that stands over against the congregation, in a way, as I just said, that the musician cannot. The musician also identifies with the people. If you think about this, you realize that the musician, you as musician, identify with your people in a way that the pastor or the presider does not. And also you have an office as the musician, whether by biblical design or sociological analysis, I don't care how you go at it, but you have an office which is much more difficult to see as distinct from the people. That makes the definition of the church musician's role a very swampy business, as you all know. And it has led to more confusion about who church musicians are than exists for clergy. The confusion, if you think about it, you realize that in every tradition, it's much more confusing to figure out who is this person who's the church musician. Many people among us in this century lament this. And they lament it because they think it lacks authority. Well, let me suggest, based on Cotton's statement here and an analysis of this, let me suggest that we ought to celebrate it. We ought to figure out what authority is intrinsic to it rather than superimposed upon it. The swampiness is in the nature of the musical beast. Evocative, memory, lyric, poetry, music, swampy, right? Always much, much more swampy than preached word or sacraments or presiding and so on. You can identify word in the one who preaches it and sacrament in the one who presides at it, if you use those terms, in a way that is impossible for the swiftly passing and evocative narrative, mnemonic, sonic, and lyric characteristics of poetry and music and their relationship to a worshiping community. To define this, it seems to me, with too much precision almost invariably means viewing music in terms of something else, so that we tend to view music and the musician in terms of word and sacrament, and viewing musicians, therefore, in terms of ordained clergy. That's the dilemma, I think. Rather than do that, why not affirm music and musicians for what they are? Why not celebrate that? And with that celebration, affirm the people's song and its importance in relation to, rather than as a subhead of, what the clergy do. In other words, what I'm arguing for here is a definition of the musician's role and vocation based on what the musician does and the authority that is intrinsic to that, rather than superimposing upon it some other definition from presiding, preaching, and so on that we normally associate with clergy. You can ponder that. That's the third point. Fourth, the question of set forms is one we tend to forget, but it is isolated quite clearly in this dispute. If you argue that corporate worship cannot have set forms but must be immediate rather than mediated through somebody else's words and forms, you will obviously not sing anything except that which is improvised on the spot. It's very clear that's what will happen, which, as I pointed out earlier, will never happen apparently if the historical models are any indication, because it's so difficult to improvise anything on the spot with the exception of the very rare individual. If you are consistent, then, and some groups have figured this out, you also will not read lessons, you will not speak the Lord's Prayer together, because those are all set forms which quench the Spirit. That's the logic of that position. Now, whether it is really possible for any community ever to gather more than once and not repeat itself is a good question. I doubt if that's possible. I think it's probably not possible. And I suspect that the opponents of Keach and Cotton created for themselves an impossible contradiction, which ultimately, I think, has the effect of destroying all corporate worship. I think that's the effect. Maybe that is why the opponents of Keach and Cotton and their congregations have had little or no ongoing existence, and why the singing position has been the more usual practice. Whether that is true or not, this conflict clearly isolates the issue. And all I'm trying to point out by isolating it here is that we should note the implications. We should note the implications, we should note the presuppositions, and know what we're talking about. This issue gets discussed among us in all denominations at the moment, and we never think out what the presuppositions are or the implications are. And it seems to me it might be well for us to read this stuff and realize what the logic is and where it leads. Finally, a general concluding comment needs to be made, which relates to the importance of singing in worship. Whether a church sings or not is a serious matter. If Karl Barth was right, Keach's choice of breach was not too strong a word. The church which is healthy will, in fact, sing. To be human is to sing, to worship is to sing. Or, as Karl Barth put it, the praise of God, which constitutes the Christian community and its assemblies, seeks to bind and commit and therefore to be expressed, to well up and to be sung in concert. The Christian community sings. It is not a choral society. Its singing is not a concert. But from inner material necessity, it sings. What we can and must say quite confidently is that the community which does not sing is not the community. That's Karl Barth speaking. Keats said it less precisely than that. Keats didn't tend to say many things very precisely. He said it less precisely than that, but he was on to exactly the same thing, I think. He could not tolerate the breach of congregations forced into silence. If we are faithful, neither will we. Maybe that's what we can most learn from this conflict.